Hello, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host today, Dr. Jay Butler. Here in the studios in Anchorage, we have not only the planned guest, the Surgeon General of the United States, but also a special guest. And we're actually going to start with a conversation with Rear Admiral Michael Waaki, the acting director of the Indian Health Service. Rear Admiral Waaki was in Anchorage and actually dropped by to talk with us today. And we have literally sat down about 30 seconds ago for this conversation. So let's start with making sure I'm pronouncing your name correctly.
Thank you, Dr. Butler. My Zuni pronunciation is Michael Waaki.
Waaki.
Perfect.
Great. So, Admiral, what brings you to Alaska?
Yes, we're excited to be here. We're here for the Alaska Native Health Board mega meeting, which is taking place this week. That's an opportunity for us to meet with and discuss issues of importance to the tribal leaders here in the state of Alaska. We're also taking advantage of the opportunity to travel out to several different sites. We visited the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation yesterday in Bethel. Got to see the progress that they're making in our joint venture project, a large hospital that will employ about 850 individuals and provide much needed services to the native people living in the Yukon Delta. Also flew out and visited Mountain Village and St. Mary's. Got to see firsthand the services being provided by the Community Health Aid Program, not only the dental health aides, but also the behavioral health aides. So that was great to see and hear about. And then we're also taking a close look at the sanitation facilities, water treatment, sewer treatment facilities, and the needs there. So a lot going on this week.
It certainly is. And it sounds like you've had a great chance to see some of the realities that we deal with here in Alaska as the Arctic state and some of the conditions in our remote areas and to the harsh climate that makes things like that we take for granted here in Anchorage, like running water and flush toilets, very, very challenging. For probably 20 years now, many of us have talked about putting the honey bucket in the museum, but that's a goal that is still a little bit too elusive for us. So for those who aren't aware, the Indian Health Service is the principal federal health care advocate and provider of health care services for American Indians and Alaska Natives. And in his role as acting director, Admiral Waaki is administering the nationwide health care delivery programs that's responsible for providing preventative, curative, and community health care, including really public health services when we talk about things like water and sanitation to over 2 million American Indians and Alaska Natives. Of course, here in Alaska, the situation is a bit different in that we're now more than two decades into tribal administration of the tribal health system. Curious your perspectives on that. Are we doing things right in Alaska? I know it's very different than many other parts of Indian country.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Butler, for that question. And I would characterize our relationship with the tribes who have taken over or self-determined their care as one of a partnership now. The federal government continues to provide the resources, and now our tribal partners are coming to us with innovative ways of providing care that we may not necessarily be able to within the federal government because of the some of the restrictions that we have placed upon us. I grew up myself as a lifelong user of the Indian healthcare system. Grew up in New Mexico. I was born in an Indian Health Service hospital in Shiprock on the Navajo Reservation. Lifelong user, almost 50 years now of our system of care. So I've seen both sides, both the federally operated and the tribally operated. And I would say that our tribal partners have done a great job at being innovative and designing a healthcare delivery system that best meets the needs of patients. You can point to just here in Alaska, the South Central Foundation being a two-time Malcolm Baldrige Award-winning institution as one bright example.
Yes. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. We welcome you to join the conversation. You can call us state-free, toll-free, statewide, at 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. That's line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. So, Admiral Wiaki, you mentioned the innovation that is possible under tribal administration and exercising the rights to tribal self-determination. What are some of the innovative things specifically that you've observed in your time in Alaska so far?
Well, I think that the first example I would point to is the Community Health Aid Program and the innovation there. So when you cannot recruit a healthcare professional into a very rural, remote location, such as a dentist or a primary care provider, you start to look for alternative solutions. And now, 50 years ago, the Community Health Aid Program was started here in Alaska to help address those unmet needs. I just returned from a visit here at the Alaska Native Medical Center to meet with the Community Health Aid Program training program, and got to hear firsthand how they've trained not only for the rural villages here, but they're now also training for rural reservations in the lower 48. So expanding this type of innovation to help meet the needs of rural reservations throughout the country is a great example of innovation that can be leveraged and replicated.
So when we talk about tribal administration, what proportion of healthcare for American Indians and Alaska Natives roughly is now under tribal administration as opposed to still being delivered by Indian Health Service?
Yes, I have a very recent statistic. As of July 1st, we've entered into 101 self-determination compacts. And going over that 100 threshold, we now have 64.57% of our American Indian Alaska Native healthcare system being run directly by tribes.
Wow. So really two-thirds of the population are served by tribal organizations now.
Yes, sir.
I didn't realize that. So I'd like to take a caller. We have Amelia. Amelia, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Hey, hello. Hello, Admiral. Thank you so much for, coming here to Alaska. My question is about addiction. It's a heck of a plague here in Alaska, and especially with the indigenous people. And we have one center with a very limited number of beds, and that's it. Anybody else who wants treatment has to go out of state at their own expense, and our state is considered out of network for a lot of insurance companies. I have pretty good insurance with my company, and everything's out of network. Everything requires pre-approval, and it's for a person who wants help, for a person who wants to get better, it's hard. And I just want to know what... we're the 49th state, but it seems like we're forgotten, truthfully. And we're trying to get better. We are Native people, myself, but it's hard with the limited resources we have. Thank you,
Admiral Wiaki. I know this isn't just a issue for us in Alaska, although, as Amelia points out, we are geographically quite remote from other parts of the country, but I'm sure you're seeing this as a challenge in other parts of the country. In your role as acting director of Indian Health Service and as you survey what's happening across the country, what are you seeing as some of the areas of progress to address these really long-standing and vexing problems? I think certainly the opioid crisis is grabbing headlines right now, but there are longstanding issues related to substance misuse and, in the more general level, behavioral health issues.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Butler, and thank you for your question, Amelia. Definitely addictions continue to plague American Indians and Alaska Natives at a higher level than most in the general population. The focus for the country currently is on opioids and the crisis that we face there. Just to provide some high-level statistics, for American Indians and Alaska Natives in the year 2015, we had the highest overdose death rates of all races and ethnicities. And from the year 1999 to 2015, we had the highest increase in the number of deaths related to opioid overdose deaths, a 519% increase in that time period. So there's no doubt that we are being impacted by the opioid crisis that affects the rest of the country. What are we doing to address it? Because as I meet with tribal leaders, not only here in Alaska, but also throughout the rest of the country, they say opioids is the crisis today, but don't forget, we still have significant problems with methamphetamine, heroin, and alcohol. I know in traveling the last 2 days here in Alaska that there's not enough resource. So we know that within our Indian Health System of Care here in Alaska, there are 5 regional treatment centers, 2 of those specific to youth and the other 3 for adults. And in a state the size of Alaska, with the geography as expansive as it is, 5 facilities doesn't seem like enough. And I think that if you talk to Native peoples in other parts of the country, you'll hear that there's a general lack of behavioral health infrastructure. So finding inpatient residential treatment beds is difficult no matter where you live. But I suspect the same holds true here in Alaska. So what we've been doing to address this is not only asking Congress for additional funds to build additional inpatient residential treatment capacity, but also to look at innovative ways to do intensive outpatient treatment, to do Medicaid or medication-assisted treatment via internet-eligible controlled substance provider. So we are developing a protocol and a policy within our agency that will authorize MAT treatment via internet or telehealth, as an example. And then we're working very closely with our tribes to hear directly from them what they believe will work best in their communities. So I think most programs that are successful because they're being developed and operated by those who know specifically what the impacts of are within their own home turf. So providing funding for community-based solutions is an important approach as well.
Well, thank you, Admiral. And thank you, Amelia, for joining us on Line 1. So Admiral Wiaki is, we focused a lot on Alaska. Of course, you have a much broader mission in terms of health all across our nation, fulfilling the federal government's obligation to tribal organizations. What are some of the priorities that you see that you would like to address during your time at the helm of the Indian Health Service?
Thank you, Dr. Butler. I would characterize our major priorities within the Indian Health Service currently under 4 major headings, those being people, partnerships, quality, and resources. Under the people priority, we as a health system have difficulty recruiting and retaining qualified healthcare professionals into rural and remote locations, so we are placing a priority on developing within our system the capabilities, either through training programs or by being innovative in the way that we recruit. We're also, through partnerships, working with universities and other academic training institutions to create pipelines or pathways to bring new professionals into the Indian Health System of Care. Also under the partnership heading, we're addressing social determinants of health. So working with partners to get up front of those issues that impact our healthcare system to address things like housing, unemployment, economic development, working with our education systems to ensure that they're prioritizing American Indian health. We're also working on healthy food availability, just as a couple of examples of some of the partnerships that we're entering into. I think when you start to talk about social determinants of health and the impacts on health overall, the healthcare system is only 20% of that equation. You've got genetics making up another 20%.
Can't do as much about that. You're stuck with your parents.
So the 60% that's right. left over are the social, behavioral, and environmental impacts. And so prioritizing partnerships with entities who can impact those upfront social determinants is important. Quality is our third heading. Anybody who's watched the news and is watching Indian healthcare knows that the Indian Health Service has had significant challenges in meeting quality of care needs in rural America. We can point to some of our facilities in the upper Midwest, South Dakota, Nebraska, as being challenging sites. So working on improving not only the management infrastructure, but also innovating our healthcare delivery model from one that may be antiquated to one that better meets the needs of our patients. We're watching closely the legislation that's been put forth to develop community outpatient hospitals. We're also partnering with our sister agencies like HRSA, the Centers for Disease Control, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to develop innovative healthcare delivery and reimbursement methodologies. And then finally, under resources, getting to the dollars and cents. I think watching closely what's happening in Washington, D.C. with the budget, we're all watching infrastructure bill conversations. I think as we identified here, we're looking at sanitation facilities, many of those facilities here in rural Alaska being very expensive to address. An infrastructure bill that was meant to address things like that could be very beneficial to Indian country. So I think those are our four major headings currently, in addition to the national focus on opioid crisis, reducing prescription drug costs, and transforming the healthcare delivery model.
Yeah, I don't know if all of our listeners are aware that there has been research conducted in Alaska looking at utilization of healthcare services within the tribal health system. And the heaviest utilization, particularly for children related to skin and soft tissue infections or respiratory tract infections, are in those areas where there's lack of access to running water and flush toilets. So we oftentimes think of sanitation in terms of having clean water to drink, but even just the water that's available for washing is a very important determinant of health. You mentioned partnerships, and I know I've been involved in a number of conversations in the past few months about the large proportion of Alaska Native and American Indian people who have served in our military. Are there opportunities for partnership with the Veterans Administration?
That is a great example of a partnership that we'd like to further flesh out. So as a veteran of the United States Air Force myself and frequent participant in VA conversations, I think that is a relationship that we can tout. We currently have a national umbrella agreement with the VA to obtain reimbursement for services provided in IHS federally operated sites. Tribes also have the opportunity to enter into individual agreements with the VA to have services that they provide reimbursed for those veterans who seek care in tribal sites. But the VA offers so much more. They have a robust workforce development training arm that I'd like to leverage and be able to use. I know that the VA has also been in discussions with the Office of the Surgeon General, my leader here next to me, in terms of conversations about having commissioned corps officers available to fulfill their rural health needs. There's probably innumerable ways that we can benefit from having a good, robust relationship with the VA. I was just talking to Mr. Helgeson here at ANMC, and he was touting the relationship that they have with the VA here in Anchorage, where when there's the need for surge capacity, we have these other federal locations, not only in the VA, but also with the Elmendorf Air Force Base, where they can transfer patients when needed. So those relationships with our sister agencies, including the VA, are very important.
Right. This is radio, so people can't see that you're here in your service dress blues, and I see a lot of ribbons on your chest, and not all of them are public health service. So I thank you for your service both in the Air Force and ongoing now in the public health service. So in the last minute or so, Admiral Wiaki, what would you like to leave with our listeners?
I think the importance of partnership and working hand in hand with our tribal leaders and partners, again, leveraging the innovation, working together to increase the amount of resource that's coming into Indian Country to meet the needs of the patients we serve. The needs are great. Our system has not historically been funded well, but it's only through great partnerships with our tribal leaders and our tribal people that we'll be able to overcome these challenges and best meet the needs of our patients.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today. We've been chatting with Rear Admiral Michael Wiaki, who is Acting Director of the Indian Health Service here on Line 1, Your Health Connection. We're going to take a minute of break time for the stations down the line, and when we return, we'll start a conversation with Dr. Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General of the United States. So talk to you in a moment, everyone.
You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line 1, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your co-host today, Dr. Jay Butler. And we have another guest in the studio today, Dr. Jerome Adams, the 20th Surgeon General of the United States. Dr. Adams, welcome to Alaska and welcome to Line 1.
Well, Dr. Butler, Jay, it's fantastic to be here, and hello, Alaska.
Well, the Surgeon General is often described as America's doctor. And you've been on the job now for about a year now, sworn in and right after Labor Day, as I recall, by Vice President Mike Pence as the 20th Surgeon General. We were just talking about the uniforms and this being radio. You know, I see a lot of stripes on your sleeves. As I'm counting, I think that's an 09. So you're actually a vice admiral.
Then, yes. Yes, I am.
Three stars. So, first of all, how do you like to be addressed? Should I call you Surgeon General? Should I call you Doctor? Should I call you Vice Admiral?
Well, that's a great question, Jay. And the truth is, I'm all three. But you can just call me Jerome. For those listeners out there, Jay and I are both good friends. We both were state health officers for our respective states. I was in Indiana, and you were still here in Alaska. But what's interesting and that I tell folks is that I'm a vice admiral, I'm a surgeon general, I'm a physician, but interestingly, I'm neither a surgeon nor a general. I also am not the Attorney General. I do not want that job, but I'm frequently called the Attorney General. And I'm also not an airline pilot. We wear uniforms that are similar to the Navy uniforms, and for anyone who's seen those, they do look similar to an airline pilot's outfit. But you do not want me flying your plane, Alaska. The United States Surgeon General, as you mentioned, serves as a three-star admiral in the United States Public Health Service. There's Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard, but there's also the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and the United States Public Health Service that compose the other two of the seven uniformed services. Our Commissioned Corps is composed of 6,500 full-time health professionals, all of whom are officers, and who have a mission to protect, promote, and advance the health and safety of our nation. I'm proud of all of our officers. Admiral Wiaki just did a wonderful job here on your show. But I think it's also important to point out that in Alaska, there are over 270 officers working to raise the physical, mental, social, and spiritual health of American Indians and Alaskan Natives, with a lot of those officers working directly for IHS to provide services to Native Alaskans.
Well, the Public Health Service has been around a long time, established during the Adams administration. You're the third Surgeon General I've seen standing on Alaskan soil. Dr. Richard Carmona was here a number of years back, actually, when the commissioned officers had their annual meeting, national meeting, here in Anchorage. Dr. Vivek Murthy was here a couple of years ago as well. And your office has certainly had a profound effect on the health of Alaska. Dr. Thomas Perrin, who was Surgeon General in the Roosevelt and Truman administrations, commissioned a comprehensive study of health in Alaska in partnership with Dr. Earl Albright, who is our first territorial commissioner for health, and working with the American Medical Association. And this ultimately led to the Perrin Report of 1954, which really defined some of the health disparities in Alaska at the time and created a set of marching orders for the federal government, as well as the territorial government and later the state government, to address. So thank you for your service also in the historical roots that you bring to your job.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we've seen for a long time that Alaska has led the country in terms of innovation, in terms of, as I like to say, MacGyvering their way to solutions. Resources aren't plentifully available out here the way they are in the lower 48, but Alaskans are some of the most industrious folks that I've ever come across, and we've seen this throughout history. So it's very important that we come out here, that we make sure we're learning from your best practices, that we are allowing Alaskan innovation, but also, as you and Admiral Wiaki discussed, that we are in a very real, intentional, deliberative way making sure we're providing those resources for our folks out here who most need them and who are facing some of the worst health disparities in our entire country.
As we were discussing earlier, the Surgeon General has been called the America's doctor. We've all seen your warnings on cigarette packs. Not that we're carrying cigarette packs as often as we used to, in part because of your warnings, as well as the Surgeon General's reports. Tell us more about the role of the Surgeon General. What's a typical day like for you? Or is there even a typical day for you?
Well, that is a great question. There really isn't a typical day, but that's part of what makes the job interesting and makes it fun. Overall, I say to folks, the job of the Surgeon General is to communicate the science around health to the American people. For me, I'll start off back when I got sworn in. I got sworn in September of last year, and there were three Category 5 hurricanes bearing down on Texas, on Florida, on the southern part of the U.S., in addition to Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands and a lot of the Caribbean. So I spent a lot of my first several months in office making sure those places in our country were getting the support that they needed. We deployed over 1,400 officers to help respond to Hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria. And so proud of the work that our officers did in that capacity. We're still helping in many ways to rebuild out there. And that was just right off the bat. We've also in the past helped respond to the Ebola situation in Africa. For me, a lot of what I do, in addition to helping provide operational leadership for the Corps, is travel around the country and learn about best practices, learn about what's working. Just yesterday, we were throughout the Anchorage area in the Mat-Su region, learning about recovery housing and support that's being provided to homeless teenagers. We were at Alaska Regional Hospital Center, learning about a program, the NEST program, that provides neonatal abstinence syndrome services for moms and babies, keeping mom and baby together, which we know results in better outcomes for both. And so learning about best practices, promoting the science around health, and then taking that feedback back to Washington, D.C., so that the Secretary, Secretary Azar, the President, and the administration can continue to support all of our citizens, and particularly Alaskans, in the best ways possible.
You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. We're talking today with the 20th Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Jerome Adams. You're welcome to join the conversation, calling us toll-free statewide at 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Adams, you said that you're not a surgeon. You're not a general. The ranks are, naval, so you would be a general if you were in the Air Force. There's no such position as the anesthesiologist general, which you are a board-certified anesthesiologist. In fact, we were talking before the show, you were saying you were providing anesthesia at Walter Reed, I believe, sometime in the past couple weeks.
So yes,
you continue to be
last Friday.
Clinically active. That's a little bit of an unusual career path into public health, certainly an unusual career path into the top public health position in the entire nation. How did you come into this role?
Well, that's a great question. And you mentioned I'm an anesthesiologist. I worked at a level one trauma center for Indiana University, and I really enjoy clinical practice. There is no greater feeling than to take care of someone who's been in a car wreck, someone who's had an unfortunate traumatic event, to stay up with them, to work on them all night long. And in some cases, I've worked on a single individual for over 12 hours to keep them alive. And at the end of your shift, to feel like you literally saved a life. But that said, there's no more depressing feeling than to do all that, and 6 months later to have that same individual end up back in your operating room on your table again from something that you knew was preventable. And so I've tried to, in my life, save the lives when they present themselves and need to be saved, provide that high-quality clinical care when I can, but also to get upstream and to try to figure out how can we stop so many people from needing care in the first place. Instead of amputating the diabetic foot, how can we help people eat healthier, move more, and do the things that prevent diabetes in the first place? Instead of taking care of that person who got shot, how can we go into communities and address trauma, address resilience, address mental health issues, so that conflicts don't turn into violence in the first place? And that got me involved in public health. I got my master's in public health at the University of California, Berkeley, 20 years ago. And then really got involved in politics and advocacy for professional organizations, and got on the radar of then Governor Mike Pence. That name may sound familiar to your listeners.
I've heard of him.
And he asked me to be his state health officer, to lead the State Department of Health in Indiana and be the top doc for that state. And I think your listeners can connect the dots from there. Governor Pence became Vice President Pence, and my name got thrown into the hat for Surgeon General of the United States. And at the end of the day, I really do feel like I was put in this position by a higher power for a reason. You mentioned it's a non-traditional route. I'm the first anesthesiologist to ever be United States Surgeon General. But I'm trained in acute and chronic pain management. I grew up in the era of pain as the fifth vital sign, where we were told and taught that that if you prescribe opioids to someone in pain, it's not going to be addictive. We know that's not true. We know that's not true. Some of your listeners may also know that I have a brother who is in state prison for crimes he committed to support his addiction. So professionally and personally, I've dealt with the opioid epidemic, and I feel like I'm here at this time because of my experience, because I can't just sympathize, but I can empathize. I've been through it. And I'm convinced that we're moving in the right direction. Amelia, I believe, was the caller who phoned in earlier, and you could hear the frustration. You could hear the pain. You could hear it in her voice. And I want to say to Amelia and to all the other listeners out there that, yes, we have an epidemic. We have a problem. But have hope. As I've traveled around the country, I've seen programs that are turning around overdose rates. I've seen mothers who have substance use disorder who've made the decisions just yesterday at Alaska Regional Hospital, who've made the decision to engage in a program that will be better for their mother and their baby. And so ultimately, I'm happy for where I am. It's a non-traditional route, but I feel like I'm the right person at the right time.
Great. As health commissioner in Indiana, when you took that seat, it quickly became a very hot seat.
Absolutely.
You had one of the medical nightmares of a large outbreak of HIV that was related to self-injection drug use. I'm sure that gave you some second thoughts about the job, but as we've actually talked about that outbreak on this show, but I was interested in hearing your perspectives from really being on the front line of that and being in Scott County and trying to oversee that response.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that here in Alaska, even though I've never been here before, I feel at home. I feel like I can relate to the folks. I grew up in a rural area in Maryland. I grew up on an old tobacco farm, on my grandfather's tobacco farm. We had hogs. We had we grew our own vegetables, and I saw what can happen when places don't get the resources that the folks in the big city get, much like a lot of Alaska. And that situation was similar to what happened in Scott County. Small town, rural, had some of the lowest high school graduation rates, some of the highest rates of medical problems, of cancer, of heart disease, and unemployment. And ultimately, as you mentioned, a town of just over 4,000 people now has 230 cases of HIV, all related to injection drug use. But what I'm proud of is how that town persevered to stop the transmission of disease and to be known not as the town where a bunch of folks got HIV, but as the town that overcame the largest HIV outbreak in the history of the United States. And they did that through partnerships. They did that by bringing together the law enforcement community, the business community, the faith-based community, and the people in that town to implement not just the science, but to really bring compassion and love to the table and to rebuild the community. And I see that that all over Alaska happening, not happening fast enough for any of us, but I think there's a lesson to be learned there, again, to not despair and to partner. My motto is better health through better partnerships, because I believe we will achieve better health through better partnerships.
Great. Well, we have an email question for you that it relates to the issue of opioids. My friend just had hip surgery. She was sent home with 60 pills of OxyContin. How do we stop this, and how does she safely dispose of the pills?
Those are two great questions. How do we stop this? Well, number one, I want to make sure as we lower prescribing that we don't overswing the pendulum in the other direction, that we make sure we're providing adequate pain management for folks. And without knowing the facts of the individual case, I can't say that that was inappropriate prescribing. But what I can say is that as an anesthesiologist, I would have at least inquired about regional anesthesia. There are blocks that you can do There are other medications that are non-opioids that can be given as part of surgeries that far too often aren't administered because the doctors don't think about them, the nurses don't bring them up, and the patients don't ask about them. We have a responsibility to be informed consumers when we go in as patients. And so I encourage folks, when they go into their doctor for surgery in particular, or when they're prescribed opioids, ask about the dangers of opioids. Ask your provider whether or not there's an alternative to opioids. My wife had major surgery earlier this year, and she was given alternatives to opioids because I asked about them, and ultimately got through that major surgery with just two opioid pills versus the 60. I'm also proud to say that due to some of the work at the State Department of Health here in Alaska, there are disposal bags available for drugs, and I would call into your health department to find out if how to get those bags. But that's a great way to dispose of your unused opioids. You can also take them back to the police station, many pharmacies, or take back sites. But I want to thank you for that question, because we know 4 out of 5 heroin users got started with a illicitly obtained prescription opioid. Put another way, that means the drug dealer is not the bad guy in the alley who we think of. The drug dealer far too often is grandma. The drug dealer is the neighbor. The drug dealer is the person who had those 60 pills, took 2 of them, and then left the rest in their medicine cabinet so that they could be diverted. So everyone has a role to play in overcoming this opioid epidemic. Ask your doctor about alternatives to opioids. Make sure you properly store opioids when they're prescribed, because there are going to be many cases when they are appropriate. But make sure you dispose of them when you're through with your course.
Great. And I'll just add, as the Alaskan in the room, that drug disposal bags are available through the public health centers around the state. There are an increasing number of opportunities for drug take back around the state. Here in Anchorage, for instance, Providence Hospital has a 24/7 available drug take back box. A number of police departments around the state are doing that as well. If anyone needs assistance in getting a drug disposal bag, just I'll say drop me an email at line1@alaskapublic.org, and we can make that connection.
And we've still got a ways to go there. We know that prescribing is down in Alaska, but we know that the number of opioids prescribed per person in Alaska is above the national average. So providers out there who may be listening, we have a big role to play in this too. We've got to do better. And I say this as someone who is still a practitioner myself. We've got to do better. We've got to step up to the plate and not just lower prescribing, but provide alternatives so we're still doing right by our patients and aren't leaving them out in the cold.
Great. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. We're going to go to a 1-minute break, and then we'll be back for a further discussion with Dr. Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General of the United States.
Funding for Line One, Your Health Connection was made possible in part by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority and listeners just like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection. This is Dr. Jay Butler, your co-host today. We are in a conversation with Dr. Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General of the United States, and you're welcome to join the conversation by calling us toll-free statewide at 888-353-5752. You can also contact us by email at line1@alaskapublic.org. I'd actually like to go to the callers. We have Kent has a question. So, Kent, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Yeah, hey, thank you. I would just like to, was wondering what Jerome thought about regulating greenhouse gases and the effect that emissions from the burning of fossil fuels affect people's health and the EPA recognition of greenhouse gases as a something to be concerned about. And, you know, from what I see happening, I think we need to be paying attention to these. And just wonder what Jerome thought about the health effects and the role of his agency in keeping track of that and doing something.
Kent,
that's
a wonderful question, and thank you for the call. Couple ways to address that. Number one, I want to be clear that my office is always going to represent the best science available, and is always going to fight to lower pollution of any type on our planet. We know, particularly here in Alaska, in many different ways, that pollution is negatively affecting the health of individuals, and that there are things that we all can do to help lower pollution and to improve health, whether it's air pollution, whether it's proper sanitation, or what have you. Now, the flip side of that is that every conversation about policy, about health policy, is going to have many different variables. Number one, we always want to make sure the science is part of that equation. But we also need to understand that jobs and the economy are part of that equation. We need to understand that we have to find the right balance between promoting health and the environment, which are very important, make no mistake about it, but also balancing that with making sure we can provide jobs for folks. I was just looking at the Alaska numbers, and Alaska's unemployment rate is almost twice the national average. So, Kent, what I would say to you honestly is that we need to make sure health people are at the table partnering with the business and the economic folks, and always having a continual discussion about where that balance needs to lie. And as people who are citizens of Alaska and citizens of the United States, I encourage you to be part of that discussion, to make sure you reach in, that you discuss with your elected representatives how you feel and where you feel on that issue. Because I think far too often we make this an all or none. You're either pro-health or you're pro-jobs, but you can't be both. We have to reject that argument. That's a faulty argument. There are ways out there to both promote the economy, to provide jobs for individuals, and to do it in a way that creates a cleaner and more sustainable environment.
Great. Thank you, Kent, for joining us on Line 1 today. In our conversation with Admiral Wiaki a little earlier, we were talking about the challenges of delivering health care in Alaska, such a large place. And I'd like to go to Brenda on the line. She has a question about telemedicine.
Hi, Brenda.
Brenda, welcome to Line 1, Your Health Connection.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm calling with a comment over telemedicine. We have a family member that has been ill for a few years and now is homebound. And we've used our resources here in the state as finding physicians to help with some kind of diagnosis. And in this course, we've come to having to pay out of pocket for having Skype appointments with the doctor down in the States. And I just find it that it could be a really great solution, if not the end result, but a good solution for helping people in our community get some services that they desperately need. And it could be maybe a stepping stone to something that's a bigger and better solution. But our insurance won't cover it. And I think there's a lot of families struggling in the same way.
Brenda, thank you so much for that, and you are exactly right. Technology has allowed for a number of new possibilities that will allow us to advance care to folks in remote areas or folks who are homebound and simply can't come in. Telemedicine is one of those ways. Project Echo is what some folks would call telemedicine on steroids. It's really a way of training the trainer and helping individuals in rural areas who are care providers become more proficient in dealing with complex diseases. And as Admiral Wiaki mentioned earlier, we also need to look at alternative care providers because we will never be able to have a doctor available in every place that we want to for every instance that we want. Now, you brought up a very fair point that we need to be able to fund these types of things so that they can happen. And Secretary Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, my boss, my immediate boss, is committed to making sure we're paying not for individual services so much as that we're paying for outcomes. And as Surgeon General, I'm focused on making sure we learn about and promote the best practices out there that will advance care to individuals in remote areas, and then that we have payment systems in place that say ultimately, okay, hey, if this is the best way to provide care to this patient, then fine, you all do that as a hospital system or as a care entity, and we're going to give you an overall payment, or we're going to give you an additional payment, actually, if you can provide better care and keep that patient out of the hospital. Again, I completely agree with you. There's a lot of potential there with technology. We need to leverage it. We need to make sure we're paying for it. And if we can do that, we'll provide better care for folks across this country.
So maybe we can have Seema Verma join us someday. Very complex answer to a question that may seem very simple, but it's not as straightforward as I think we would all like to believe that it is.
Exactly. There's actually some interesting data out there. Telemedicine can be a good thing, but there's some data out there that suggests that when not done in a proper and evidence-based way, that it may actually harm outcomes. And so we want to make sure we're providing the best care for folks, that we're doing it the right way. And that's where also leveraging our academic partners is important, making sure we're evaluating programs and doing things in a way that promotes health and provides the best care for all. And then we can move to a place where we're making sure we're paying for it.
Great. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your co-host today, Dr. Jay Butler, talking with Dr. Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General of the United States. Dr. Adams, I've heard you say something that I've not heard people in your role say before, and that's discussing health as a national security issue. Tell us more about that.
Well, a shocking statistic, Dr. Butler, 7 out of 10 young people in our country are actually ineligible for military service. 7 out of 10. So that means that our country's poor health isn't just a matter of diabetes or cardiovascular disease 20 years down the road. We are truly a less safe country right now because we're an unhealthy country. And that's why I have been partnering with the other uniformed services. I've met with the Surgeons General of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and we're committed to both working to build healthier communities so that folks go into the military more fit and that they can maintain a healthier lifestyle, but also leveraging our partners. I've heard that there are over 10,000 troops here in Alaska, 10,000 members of the uniformed services.
Active duty,
yes.
Uniform personnel.
And okay. Many, many more individuals who are retired. And thank you all so much for your service if you've served. I know that Alaska has a higher percentage per capita of individuals who've served than anywhere else. And in particular, our Native Alaskans have served at a higher rate than any other ethnic group. But that said, there's a lot of potential. There's a lot of opportunity out there. And it's imperative that we do this, not just from a health point of view, but from a national security point of view. One more shocking statistic, 70% of those who are active duty live off base. So we aren't going to make them healthier or help them stay ready simply by focusing on what happens on base. We need to get out into communities and create healthier communities so that we can create a safer country.
Great. I'd like to take one more caller. Gladys, welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thank you, and good morning.
Good morning,
Gladys.
I'm calling about my husband who is served in public health service for 2 years, 55 to 57, here at the Indian at the Native Hospital.
Okay.
And chose to stay in Alaska in public life. Worked in pharmacy until he was age 76 here in Anchorage. And for some reason, we don't seem to be able to find out how to get veterans benefits. Are they not recognizing public health service anymore?
Gladys, that is a wonderful question. And what we will do is follow up with you offline and make sure we can run that to ground, because we want to make sure anyone who has served in uniform in our country is being taken care of in the best possible way. I don't know if you have access to email, but Dr. Butler, what's a good way for us to get Gladys's contact info?
Yeah, Gladys, if you have access to email, you can send it to my attention at line1@alaskapublic.org, or you could call the station. And in fact, I think if we use the number that you're calling now after we're offline, we can get you connected up with someone who might be able to give you some guidance in terms of those benefits. So Gladys, thank you for joining us here on Line One, your health connection. So Dr. Adams, we're down to the final 2 minutes or so. What are some of your impressions of Alaska? And I'm sure you've come away with some impressions in terms of things that are good and maybe some of our challenges as well.
Well, certainly the challenges relate to the large geographical area, the remote regions, the lack of resources, but the benefits, the assets, the positives come in the way of folks have no choice but to partner. Folks have no choice but to be innovative, and as I mentioned earlier, we're seeing some of the numbers turn around in regards to the opioid epidemic because of that innovation, and because of that MacGyver spirit. You and I just this morning were meeting with law enforcement officers, with the Attorney General, with the U.S. Attorney. And we're seeing these partnerships. The Coast Guard was there. The U.S. Marshal was there. I've never seen such a gathering of high level individuals committed to promoting health, and it gives me hope. It really does. It's more of what we need to happen across the country. But as we finish, I'd leave your listeners with a call to action, and that's to figure out how you can take a bite of this elephant. We talked about it, the old saying, how do you eat an elephant one bite at a time? In Alaska, maybe we should say, how do you eat a whale? But at the end of the day, we all need to figure out how we can take our bite out of it. And we need folks to be safe with their prescriptions. We need folks to learn about and be willing to carry naloxone so that they can save lives. And we need folks to continue to partner and be innovative.
Great. Thank you. Dr. Jerome Adams, the Surgeon General of the United States, thank you for coming to visit us in Alaska. Thank you for joining us today on Line One, your health connection. So next week on Line One, we'll have the return of host emeritus Dr. Thad Woodard for a discussion of artificial intelligence, robotics, and your health. Dave Waldron produced today's program. The multi-talented Eric Bork is our web editor, and the sound engineer today was again Dave Waldron. Welcome back, Dave. So this is Dr. Jay Butler wishing you a healthy life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.